This is The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly. Liverpool blink in the title race after absolutely battering Manchester United for 45 minutes. They somehow need a Mo Salah penalty to rescue a point, which in the end might not be a disaster, but it'll feel like one today. There were wonderful finishes from Bruno Fernandes and Kobbie Mainoo in a typically weird United performance. That means Arsenal stay top on goal difference, a ruthlessly professional job at Brighton, creating chances, defending brilliantly. Surely at some point, some people will think they're more likely to do it than Manchester City, for whom Kevin De Bruyne decided to remind us that he is still really good. In the race for the top four, Aston Villa concede 3 in 9 minutes at home to Brentford, eventually salvaging a point, but it means Spurs are in the box seat after a 3-1 win at home to Forest. Has anyone kicked it harder than Mickey van der Ven? Apart from Chris Wood, perhaps, absolutely smashing the post from 2 yards out. At the bottom, huge wins for Everton and Luton. We'll do the rest of the Premier League, look back on that ludicrous Man U Chelsea game from Thursday night, and pay tribute to Joe Kinnear, who's died at the age of 77. All that plus your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Barry Glendenning, welcome.
Hi, that Man U Chelsea game seems a long time ago now, doesn't it?
Well, I was going to say, me and producer Joel made an executive decision to go, that's not that interesting. We don't need to do a pod on Friday. And as it was happening, we were like, oh, maybe we've dropped a bollock here. Anyway, Jonathan Wilson, hello.
Morning, how are you doing?
I'm very good. And not before time, a much needed Brummy voice. If nothing else, to stop Jordan Jarrett Bryan in his tracks. Dan Bardell, welcome.
I'm not sure by the end of it that many people will be as complimentary about my voice as you've just been.
No, it's good. We like a broad church on this, and it's something that's definitely been missing from this podcast for a while. Let's start at Old Trafford then. Manchester United 2, Liverpool 2. I mean, it is always a story, Barry, when one of the top three drops points, and you always felt that Man United would be tricky for Liverpool, even though it shouldn't be. But after that first half, it seems ridiculous that they didn't win.
Yeah, I mean, I don't really know where to start with this game. And I should, because we've been here before with these teams quite recently. And even though, you know, you see a team waste chance after chance after chance and Liverpool go in 1-0 up, you would think, oh, they could pay for this. But I didn't think they would. I thought they'd just continue as they had gone on and end up running out 4 or 5 nil winners, because as we've said it time and again, Manchester United are very easy to play against. An increasingly apoplectic Gary Neville sort of explained during the first half exactly why they're so easy to play against, because their midfield has a habit of going AWOL and there's nothing connecting the front and back of the sides. But yeah, they sort of scored with a kind of freak, brilliant goal after Liverpool had missed all these chances. And then somewhat incredibly went ahead with a brilliant goal from Kobbie Mainoo, who's really having a great first season. But we saw the best and worst of quite a few players in this game. And I would say Kobbie wasn't perfect by any means, but that was a brilliant goal. His first at Old Trafford, one he'll always remember. And just a wonderfully chaotic game. And I still can't quite believe that Liverpool didn't win it. And Jurgen Klopp was, I thought, oh, he's going to be really ratty after this one. Really ratty.
Sounds like you were looking forward to it.
I was looking forward to it, yeah. Because he's, you know, when things don't go his way, he can be very narky, as can we all, I'm sure. But he was sanguine enough. But yeah, Liverpool could rue those missed chances. And it's interesting, Darwin Nunez, I love him as a player, and he sort of personifies the chaos of this game, but his record against the top six is piss poor. He hasn't scored against any of them, as far as I know.
Is this, are we counting Man United as the top six? Or the big six?
Well, they're old sixth, school, aren't they?
Oh, that is, oh, yeah, no. seems very fair. I've had a long flight, Barry.
Sorry.
But yes, yeah, they are six. I mean, Dan, it's interesting, isn't it? We know footballers are good, right? And we know they're good at kicking the ball. But when someone hits a ball like Fernandes, like that, there's nothing better, really. I mean, it's just so perfect.
Oh, it was a sumptuous strike from absolutely nowhere as well. But that is the stuff he's capable of. I just don't think we've seen enough of that this season from Bruno Fernandes. He's not alone because we can do to death how poor Manchester United are throughout the team. But he is their captain. He should be their talisman. He's been their talisman previously. But I just think with the whole team, I watch Manchester United, and this doesn't answer the question that you've asked me at all about Bruno Fernandes. But I almost feel like sometimes they do things because they feel it's what they should do. So Dalot comes into midfield, and I think Dalot is a perfectly good right back, probably been one of their better players this season. But Dalot ventures into central midfield because it's kind of that's what Liverpool right backs do. That's what Manchester City right backs do. But I don't feel it particularly offers them anything. And it's interesting you mentioned Darwin Nunes because Roy Keane last week called Haaland a League Two striker. I was watching Nunes and Hoyland and thinking, What does Roy Keane think of those? Are they Conference North strikers? Are they Conference South strikers? Because Hoyland in particular just was not in the game at all. And I think it just must be so difficult being a number nine in that Manchester United side.
Wilson, you wrote a piece about the sort of 28,000 shots that Man United have faced against Liverpool this season and yet haven't lost any of these games.
Yeah, 87 shots, I think it is in total, across the three games plus extra time. To an extent, it's a freak, right? It can't happen. It shouldn't happen. And yet, it's not just it's happened in the games against Manchester United. Liverpool also had long periods of a game second half of a game against City at home when they were on top and couldn't get the winner. They also had periods against Arsenal when that was true at home. And so those four games, they've had the better XG in each of them and they haven't won them. Thiago Jota has missed all four of them, which I think is maybe significant that his precision isn't there. But I felt in the cup game and then again yesterday, like Liverpool it's almost like they needed the defenders there to give them markers to know what to do. It was almost, they had so much space, it sort of scrambled their heads. And so they kept on having these sort of 4-on-2 breaks and nothing would come of them because they couldn't work out. What? Hang on, this isn't right. Something's gone wrong here. I don't feel comfortable without a player. I need a player to come towards me to tell me when to pass it. And I did start to think, is Ten Hag doing this on purpose? Is this sort of his grand plan to kind of mess up his head by not doing any of the basics of defending? But I think the most, on the United midfield, I think the most extraordinary stat is that United's central midfield three in total made the same number of interceptions as Anthony Taylor, the referee, yesterday, which is, say, two.
Bad.
Well, it's interesting what Wilson says there, because in their past three games, so like in a week, Manchester United have conceded 28 shots against Liverpool, I think, 28 against Chelsea, 32 against Brentford. They've only lost one of those games, and that was a kind of a freak defeat, really. So maybe he is doing it on purpose.
I mean, I would argue that they were freak draws, to be fair, rather than freak defeats. But it was similar to the Chelsea game, right? In that the opposition team was ahead, it seemed to be totally in control, and then suddenly that team makes a ludicrous mistake on which United capitalised. Exactly the same. The Kwanzaa misplaced pass leads to the United goal. In the same way, the Caicedo misplaced pass leads to the United goal on Thursday. So they've got this capacity to sort of lull you into this sort of false sense of security that you just start end up stroking about the back, not really concentrating, and then they pounce. And they do have good players. Yeah, Bruno Fernandes will take chances. Hoyland will take chances. Kobbie Mainoo can do brilliant things, but they're just sort of shambolically organised.
I kind of feel, though, like those two goals you talk about, the Kwanzaa mistake and the Caicedo mistake, almost in Ten Hag's head, because he's been a bit deluded in some of the stuff he said recently, I feel like he'll be thinking, oh, the Manchester United press, absolutely spot on. But it's not, is it? It's just two real basic errors. It's nothing to do with Manchester United pressing and how good they are. It's just errors from the opposition. But I feel like Ten Hag will be able to dress that up and say, it's signs that we're improving. It's signs that we're doing what I want us to do. But really, it's just mistakes.
Yeah, but just lulling the opposition by being so shite that you make the opposition think this is really easy and then you make a mistake is actually genius. So ultimately, Barry, and there is no, you don't have the answer to this, but do you think, when we look back, this will be this is the 2 points dropped? Or do you think actually that point they've rescued might just be enough? It's your heart tell you.
I think Arsenal are going to win the league. But, you know, they might not.
And you base that obviously on that amazing... Well, you base it on what? We can talk about their win now. Like, it was just so... It sort of felt effortless, their win at Brighton. It was like they got every single thing right. Against the Brighton team, didn't... I don't think they played that badly.
They didn't play that badly, and they're missing a lot of players. But Arsenal, I thought they might struggle. I didn't expect them to do anything other than win, but I thought they'd get more of a game. But, you know, it's they're very good at keeping clean sheets away from home. I'm not sure their running is as straightforward as the other two teams. They still have Villa, Wolves, Chelsea, Spurs. You know, they could all be tricky enough games. Bournemouth and Everton at home are the standout easy ones. But I just think, and it's probably because I want them to, of the three teams involved, I think I'd prefer Arsenal to win, but I think Arsenal will do it. They just have a ruthless streak that was conspicuously absent last season.
What are you laughing at, Wilson?
So there's a cat, a new cat suddenly appeared, and it's sitting on the terrace. Welcome. And it was sort of sunning itself there. He's a big lad. And there's a magpie. There's magpies nest somewhere near here, so they're always about. And there's one of them just sort of literally just walked up behind it. And the cat knows it's looking over its shoulder. And the magpie's sort of a little bit nervous, and the cat just goes back to sleep. And the magpie comes and literally just pecks its tail. That was what I was laughing at.
Well, Springwatch. I mean, it's about time for it, isn't it? Perfectly. On the panel today, Bill Oddie and Michaela Strachan. Why not? If I can bring you to Brighton Arsenal, Wilson, if you don't mind. I can't recall a chance for Brighton in this game. And defensively, Arsenal are ridiculous, aren't they? Sort of Baz touched on it. Only David Reyes conceded 4 goals this year. And five clean sheets away in a row, away from home, is that sort of amazing statistic.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the XG against stats, they're way ahead of everybody. And I think that's another reason why you sort of... To say you doubt Liverpool maybe is the wrong phrase, but come the end of the season, Liverpool haven't won the title. I think they look at how often they've gone behind this season. I think they've 27 points they've picked up from losing positions this season, which from one point of view is good because they have the spirit to come back. But on the other hand, why do they keep going? I think it's 15 different occasions when they've fallen behind and come back. And City, I think, are surprisingly high on that. I think the second in the list might be 12 or 13. Arsenal just don't do it. Arsenal are by far the best team defensively in the Premier League. And Brighton only lost one previous game at home this season, and yet Arsenal didn't give them a sniff. It just absolutely crushed them. So what could have been a tricky fixture, and you think of the way Brighton at the Emirates last season, that was the game really that ended Arsenal's title challenge. And yet Arsenal were absolutely ruthless in it.
And the way that second goal, the Havertz goal, it's just brilliant football, Dan, isn't it?
Yeah, and there's something, I've got nothing against Chelsea per se, but there's something very satisfying about Jorginho and Havertz linking up for that goal to two players that were very much derided at Stamford Bridge and now a big part of an Arsenal team that could go on and win the league whilst Chelsea languish in mid-table. But it just shows you that Arteta, he is a moulder of a player. He spotted two players there that maybe weren't doing what they should be doing at Chelsea, and he's brought them into Arsenal and got them playing at the top of their game. I think it was a joyous goal. But Arsenal are just the complete team at the moment. All over the pitch, you could pick out key players for them. It's the old adage of, strikers win games, but defenders win titles. And you do feel that with Saliba and Gabriel, that's the most stable partnership in the Premier League at the moment. And they could be a huge reason as well why Arsenal win the league.
They have to keep them fit.
That's what cost them last season, isn't it?
Have to keep them fit.
Is it still Rob Holding who's just waiting to come in?
No, he's currently injured at Crystal Palace, I think.
Yeah.
Ah, all right. So he's unlikely to. unlikely to be selected.
I thought it was telling the Klopp indulged in a. I don't know if it is mind games because we haven't had any mind games for ages. I'm now not confident. I can actually pick what a mind game is anymore. But he said, he was asked yesterday.
Did he say, they've got to go to Tottenham and get something and I would love it because then maybe I'd say it is?
He kind of did. Yeah. So he was asked, you know, Arsenal have to come to Old Trafford. Do you think that's, you know, a key fixture in the title race? And he said, you know, if United play like they did today, then Arsenal will win easily because they're very, very good. And you still think, well, that's just true. But B, it is a little bit mind gamey because it does say to Arsenal, well, yeah, you're going to walk this. You expect us to win it, which maybe could increase that sense of, you know, if Ten Hag's great new tactic is to induce complacency, that might work. But it might also give United a bit of a kick up the arse of kind of, you know, we can't be that bad again.
Yeah. I mean, Keegan was reacting to the mind games for anyone and reacting perfectly well, I thought, and completely measured in whatever year that was. Barry, any case for that not being a penalty? I just wondered, like, how much ball do you have to get before it was that one where he sort of got not quite enough of the ball and quite a lot of the player?
I don't know how much of the ball you have to get. I suppose it's at the referee's discretion or the VAR official's discretion, but you obviously need to get more ball.
more ball and less player. That's the ideal.
Yeah, more ball, less player. Yeah, I don't know is the answer.
There's nothing in the law about getting a touch on the ball. The law just says it's an offence if you trip or attempt to trip an opponent. So manifestly, Gabriel Jesus was tripped, and the fact there was a little push on the ball first. Because the thing is, yes, there was contact on the ball, but Gabriel Jesus was going to get the ball and carry on into the box. So I think that's probably, you know, at some sort of subconscious level, that's what you base it on, is has the ball been knocked away from the player in possession? So there's a new development in the whole cat thing.
Excellent. Good to hear.
So the original cat is called Albert. He's a bit of a prima donna. I haven't seen him all morning. He suddenly turned up. Now the other cat's been chased off by the magpie that pecked its tail. So it's almost like the original occupants of a courtyard have reclaimed the territory from the insurgent.
Crystal Palace 2, Manchester City 4 then, obviously. Dan, this is a question I'd normally reserve for Barry. And I think in the midweek after that Phil Foden performance, we started saying maybe, you know, Phil Foden has taken Kevin De Bruyne's mantle. And Kevin De Bruyne took it back quite well. And so it's a question along the Kevin De Bruyne is good at football, isn't he, Dan?
Oh, just effortless. I just feel like he doesn't look like he should be good at football. When he does a trick or runs with the ball, I don't feel like he looks like a natural footballer. But everything he just does is just out of this world. He's beautiful and, like I say, does feel so effortless. I mean, it's a lovely position to be in, to just sit Foden on the bench for 90 minutes and just bring in De Bruyne, who sat on the bench against Villa for 90 minutes in midweek. The collection of lovely footballers that Manchester City have, and lovely goals that they're capable of scoring, because Foden scored some lovely goals against Villa in the week. I just think that they're an incredible outfit. And De Bruyne, is he the best midfielder that's ever played in the Premier League? I think he probably is.
Yeah, I can't. I don't have one to. No, I don't have one to come back to you. I could only think of utterly ridiculous. I just wanted to say Vinny Samways, but you know, that's a ridiculous set. I could list a lot of Premier League centre midfielders, as people know. And the way he moved his feet. I mean, I don't know which goal is better, but the second one, he has to really adjust his feet so quickly, doesn't he?
Yeah. Yes, he does. It was nifty footwork. I think the shot was more impressive, but City started this game obviously quite badly and went behind. And I think this is a game Palace, even though they got beaten 4-2, can take quite a few positives from. But it just must be so mentally and physically exhausting playing against that side. There were long periods of the second half where they just could not get near the ball. And I think it's boring to watch. Other opinions are available. Obviously, Man City fans love it, but just this total domination of a side that's comprised of quite good footballers who aren't playing badly. It's just phenomenal.
On the topic of boring, like, people say that Jack Grealish has become a lot more boring since he left Villa to go to Manchester City, but I just think he's become such a wonderful player. And if you actually speak to match-going Manchester City fans all season, they've been saying, we miss Jack Grealish. You know, Doku's played there. I think Bernardo Silva's played there. Foden will have played there on occasion. But in the big games, Grealish always gets picked. And I would level that against Real Madrid in the week. He will get picked again because he does both sides of the game. And he was a really important part of that treble-winning team last season. And he hasn't played enough this season due to injury. And I think people almost write him off as if, you know, he's going to leave Manchester City, they're going to get rid of him. But if you speak to any Manchester City fan that watches them every week, he is in their best 11. And I just thought it was nice to see him getting some rhythm again and being involved in the game.
I think it's significant he played so well after getting that very public dressing down from Guardiola. That can go one or two ways, right? He could sort of go into a shell and sulk, and he hasn't. He's come out and had probably his best performance of the season. And I think you're right. I'd be surprised if he doesn't play against Madrid, because Docker gives the ball away too much. For all that he's, you know, creates things, if you look at their defensive record when Docker plays as compared to when Grealish plays, Grealish's use of the ball, his capacity not to lose the ball is way greater.
Just on the subject of public dressing downs, I'm surprised Rodri or John Stones didn't get a performative dressing down, because they each made two mistakes in the same game. I mean, that just doesn't happen.
Yeah, and actually it was interesting. I mean, Rodri didn't have a great game. It's so weird to watch Rodri doing anything wrong, isn't it? And actually, I saw a lot of people saying, Wilson, that Akanji coming on for Guardiola at half-time made a big difference to City. And in my mind, you're just replacing one quite talented lump with another quite talented lump there. And clearly, they're markedly different players, or just Akanji played very well and Guardiola wasn't playing that well. I don't know if you spotted that or thought anything of it.
I mean, I think City were, after the first sort of 15, 20 minutes, I think City were pretty comfortable in the first half. So I'm not sure how much difference it really made, but I don't think Guardiola's had a great season. I think, yeah, we spent a long time sort of saying City never get it wrong with a transfer. Yeah, every time they go out and spend money, it's well spent. And you know, we've been used to sort of people with that level of resource coming in and doing stupid things like buying Robinho or Balotelli or big names who don't necessarily fit together. And one of the reasons the City programme has been so effective is that they haven't been doing that. Now, I'm not saying Guardiola's a bad signing. You know, we've seen plenty of players who take the second season to really settle under Guardiola, and you know, he probably will improve, and I don't think he's been terrible this season, but I think there are, for the first time, questions about a couple of recent City signings. Matheus Nunez being, I guess, the most obvious one, but yeah, Guardiola, I think, has not been that great. He hasn't looked the player at City that he looked in the World Cup.
The official line, by the way, is that he'd picked up a niggle and that's why he came off.
Fair enough. Just a lot of people messaged. We went through the fixtures on Wednesday's pod and I missed out that City still had to play Spurs because it's not in the fixture list yet, unless it's been added in the last day or two. So that is potentially the trickiest game.
And it's probably going to be that last week of the season, isn't it? I think that's the only time it logically fits in, which may be good for City because it may be they've already got a lead by then and so it doesn't matter. Or it might be that they suddenly have two high-pressure games in that last week and that might make it trickier.
Yeah. All right, that'll do for part one. Part two, we'll begin with the race for fourth place. Hi, Pod fans. Football Weekly is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted to League Two after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League One? FX's Welcome to Wrexham, all new Thursdays on FX. Stream on Hulu. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. So Villa 3, Brentford 3, from 2-0 up to 3-2 down to drawing 3-3. Dan, how did you... Thomas Frank said this is why the Premier League is the greatest league in the world. Always nice to hear a manager saying that. Did you feel, as you were leaving the stadium, this is the greatest league in the world?
I still don't really know what I think about Saturday. You know, to be 2-0 up and completely in control like Villa were, they did the two perfect things that you can do in a football match. They scored a goal just before half-time to go 1-0 up, and then scored one straight after half-time to go 2-0 up, and you think, kill the game. Because in the first half, Brentford were pretty much defending in the north stand. You know, they had 11 men on the ball. They were, you know, I couldn't tell you how deep they were. Villa 2-0 up, seemingly cruising. It was a position that in the first half of the season and the back end of last season, Villa just see that game out. But there's been a worrying pattern in recent Villa games of crosses, and when teams have had a go at us, we have folded, and that was exactly what happened. A crazy 10 minutes where, you know, Mads Jorgensen starts it off with one of the weirdest goals I think I've ever seen.
Such a centre-back goal, Park. Isn't it? So good. Oh,
I mean, to be fair to him, he deserves it, because he must be the only centre-back whose Premier League career spans Huddersfield and Brentford, and that's it. You know, it was just such a ridiculous goal, and then Villa just capitulated. Brentford did the opposite of what they did in the first half, kept throwing men into the box, and Villa just couldn't deal with crosses. Konsa had a difficult time, probably the worst game he's had this season, and he's playing it right back at the moment. And in the end, you think, did Villa do well to get a point? But you know, once you turn it up, you shouldn't find yourself in that position in the space of 10 minutes. And ultimately now Spurs are in the driving seat for fourth.
Yeah, you turned Sergei Reguilon into, you know, the assist king, didn't you? I mean, I guess the expectations change, don't they, as a football fan, so quickly. So, you know, like because the way you started your season, especially the home form, it must, I don't know if it's now because your home form has, it was obviously going to slip. You can't just win every game. That's just not how it works. But because that happened early in the season, carried on from last season, does it feel even stranger when you don't win?
Yeah, I think I was of the mind that it wasn't sustainable what Villa were doing. It was the most ridiculous run of home form I've ever seen, and I've been going for 31 years now. I've sat there every week at Villa Park, and it felt like Villa were like just churning out results. But they had that run where they played Manchester City and Arsenal in the space of a few days, and they scored a goal against Arsenal. You know, every pass, the weight was perfect. They almost knew where each other were going to be, and everything just felt so precise as they were going through the gears. I haven't felt like that since Christmas. I don't know whether it's because Villa have had injuries that have gone under the radar, but Villa just haven't felt like they've got that same kind of zip to their play, and they were sloppy across the whole game against Brentford. Even Douglas Luiz, who's a great passer of the ball, you know, he's making the wrong decision and giving the ball away, and I just think we've kind of run out of gas a little bit. The players have played a lot of games. Villa don't have the biggest squad. And I think Spurs are starting to get players back, whereas every week Villa seem to lose someone. Villa have got Thursday night football as well now, which for the first time this season, I felt like that's starting to play a part now. So I just think at a time when Spurs feel quite energised, it feels like Villa's energy is getting sapped a little bit.
Fifth is not a crime for Aston Villa, is it, Barry? Probably in any season. And they'll probably get Champions League football with that anyway.
That'd be terrific. But I don't think anyone was predicting it at the start of the season. I still think fourth is within their reach, given their injury list. They lost Emi Buendia and Tyrone Mings very early in the season. Was it both of them in the first week?
Opening day, yeah.
They've seen Camara, Ramsey, Courtney House, Matty Cash is out at the moment. But, you know, we suppose for balance, we need to say that Brentford have also been absolutely ravaged by injury. There are a few clubs who've been just had horrible luck with them. And I think I noticed over the weekend, I think Fulham put out no injuries whatsoever. How do you get to this season, at this stage of the season, not have a single player out? But, yeah, fifth would be brilliant for Villa, but I still think they can get fourth.
Ivan Toney and Nathan Collins had a big row after the game. I didn't see it, did anyone see it? Did anyone see?
I mean, Ivan Toney, I wouldn't say he went full Pep with it, but it wasn't far off giving Collins a little bit of a dressing down. I think it was to do with the breakdown of an attack at the end of the game, but you know, there wasn't much in it. But of course, it was clipped up everywhere on social media and made out to be this big exciting thing. But no, storming a teacup probably.
So Spurs beat Forest 3-1. What did you make of this one, Wilson?
I mean, it was very Spurs, wasn't it? You don't quite trust them, but they are good enough to beat most teams. And they've got goals from defence, which is a big thing. I mean, two great finishes from Van der Ven and Porro. Werner, you know, as long as you're not actually asking him to score goals, he's brilliant. And I would assume that they'll be quite happy to pay him £15 million for him at the end of the season.
Yeah, I think so.
Because I think the way he works that channel, his running, his defensive work, his energy, those low crosses are incredibly dangerous. I mean, maybe it would have been different if Chris Wood hadn't managed to miss or hit the post from 2 yards. But somehow he did. So yeah. I mean, it was. I felt very sorry for Alan. It was Alan Smith doing the commentary, wasn't it? So yeah, you know, he'd sort of said when Chris Wood scored the first goal, oh, you know, when you're in form, yeah, it just feels like you're on the training field. You just can't miss. And then literally, and the thing is, that finish, it was the right thing to say. Yeah. And then 2 minutes later, he's thudding the post from 2 yards. Doesn't look like a training field anymore.
Yeah, Nathan says, how much wood would a Chris Wood hit? And would it count as a shot on target? It might have gone out for a goal kick. I mean, it might have gone out for a corner, rather. Like you hit it so hard. Like, it was just sort of impossible. You sort of think, if you hit it that hard, maybe the goal will sort of bend and it'll go in anyway. It was just astonishing not to see it go in.
Well, I was just going to say, I mean, this game could have been completely different if he hadn't smashed that one off the post. Because an in-form Chris Wood, you do expect him to score that. And then there was the...
I mean, I expect an out-of-form Chris Wood to score that.
Yeah. The weird James Maddison shovey slash punch on Ryan Yates, which should have earned him a red card.
Yeah. And, do you think it should?
And interestingly, Ryan Yates demanding the VAR look at it, that would have got him a second yellow card. So maybe they should both have been sent off.
But how do we feel about a one-inch punch? It's very kung fu, isn't it? Really, like, to knock someone out with that much... Does James Maddison have that much power? I mean, it is letter of the law, Dan. That is punching someone, isn't it? I mean, I think it is. But I can see why they thought, well, it's not... It's only a little one to... It's only a little jab in the ribs.
These are just the kind of decisions where if, you know, the ref had seen it and sent him off, VAR isn't going to disagree with it. So that's the thing that I find preposterous about VAR is that, you know, if decisions are given a certain way, that impacts how VAR reacts. I watched Maddison, you know, when John McGinn went in hard the other week at Villa Park and got a red card. I watched Maddison in the ear of the referee demanding justice, demanding vengeance and a red card. And then a few weeks later, he's punching someone in the stomach. That was my biggest takeaway from it.
I'm not sure you can compare that jab in the ribs to John McGinn trying to kick Destiny Doggy out of Villa Park.
Yeah. Well, although let us not gloss over the fact that Dan was claiming that was a terrible decision and never a red card at the time.
I did do that. I'm probably still not over. Yeah, I mean, it was very biased. It was very biased on my behalf. I didn't say it was reasonable when Jonathan and I had that conversation. But surely, you know, going and kicking someone as John McGinn did, if that's a red card, I would say going to someone and punching them is probably a red card as well.
Yeah, yeah.
I now think, and we'll get to the Wolves-West Ham game, I now think all contentious refereeing decisions should be referred to Gary O'Neill, because I want to hear what he has to say about them following his comments over the weekend.
We'll get to that. Worth mentioning, Tottenham changed their centre midfield at half-time and Bentancur Højbjerg came on, and that seemed to make a difference. And Højbjerg's quite an interesting, sort of a real case, Wilson, of like the ultimate professional, right? He was, I read some story that Ange saw him take the ball on the half turn in one training session, was like, he's not for me. And yet he's really relied on him in key moments of key games, even if he's not getting a lot of football.
Well, I think that's a great element of Postecoglou's management, that there doesn't seem to be anybody who's been ostracised from a squad. There's players who don't play very often, but they come in and they seem quite happy and they seem quite motivated, and it doesn't seem to be a squad that has any sulkers at the moment. And I think you've got to give Postecoglou credit for that, given what we'd seen with the same group of players last season. Basuma's form's dropped off quite badly, hasn't it? So I think that is a bit of a concern for Spurs. But it's good that they've got the four of them. Yeah, I think Saad had a very good first season in the Premier League. Bentancur, I know he's maybe not quite back to the levels he was at before the knee injury, but I think he's a great player. So yeah, it's a benefit of having four good midfielders that you can change two of them and bring on two good ones.
He's so convincing, is Ange, Barry, that I believe him when he says he doesn't care about finishing in the top four. Of course, he probably does.
I'm sure he does, yeah. But again, like Villa, fifth place finish would be entirely acceptable. And he got into it, didn't he, with some journalists. Well, it wasn't being chippy or anything, but just discussing the importance of... The journalists were trying to say Spurs need to be in the Champions League to generate the income they need to build the squad and, you know, get into this cycle. And he was saying that it wasn't that important. I wasn't entirely convinced, but he did make a good case.
Well, Spurs have announced their financial results this week, haven't they? Showing losses for the fourth consecutive year, which, yes, maybe they do need another income stream like the Champions League.
Let's talk about Joe Kinnear, who has passed away at the age of 77. Younger listeners, most of us know him as a manager, his success at Wimbledon and probably less success, a bit of success at Luton and less elsewhere. But as a player as well, he played 10 years at Spurs, won the FA Cup, the League Cup twice, and the UEFA Cup. You wrote a nice piece about him, Wilson.
Thank you. Yeah, I think it's just sad that somebody who gave so much to football, I think he was a good manager. I think he's a very, very good player. And unfortunately, what we remember is the sweary rant at the end. I mean, at the end, 2008. And then the very sort of confused interviews he gave as Newcastle's director of football a year before he's diagnosed with dementia. You can't overlook that, because they did happen. And I don't think you should be going into a press conference and swearing 53 times in the first 5 minutes. And that press conference is one of the most memorable of all press conferences. You know, if you look at the transcript now, there's two or three absolutely hysterically funny lines there. We were able to joke about it, I think, because Simon Bird, the journalist he really went for, was able to handle it and you know, dealt with it very well and wasn't sort of noticeably like shaken or upset by it, didn't have a go back, but was very, very calm. So it became a sort of comedy set piece. But yeah, you shouldn't write that the story, but we should be aware that the story is bigger than that. And what he did at Wimbledon was astonishing. I mean, he got them to sixth, which is they finished sixth twice. That's the highest position they've ever been in. He took them to eighth, but yeah, with very, very low budget. They got to this year, they finished eighth. They got the semi-final of both domestic cup competitions. I think as well that press conference and the subsequent stuff, I think it tends to gloss over the fact that everybody seemed to like him. So Jimmy Hill said he had a kind of happiness about him. I was talking to the commentator Dave Farrer this morning, and he said that, jokingly, it was his co-commentator, I think he said year 2000, I might be wrong about the tournament, and said that, you know, he was just a very funny, great bloke. But he did say that he went to an Indian restaurant with him, and jokingly, he was 53 at the time, had no idea what an onion bhaji was, had never come across one before.
At 53?
At 53, yeah. Despite having been manager of India for a while, which seems quite odd. But yeah, and as a player, you know, he played, I think it was 196 league games for Spurs, only scored twice, so very much an old school type of fullback, I think. That period, late 60s, early 70s, when Spurs were really sort of confirming their position as a great cup team, I think they were defensively a lot tighter than the stereotype of Spurs would have it. So he won the FA Cup in 67 as a 20-year-old when they beat Chelsea in the final. He won two league cups. He was part of the team that beat Wolves in the UEFA Cup final. And I was slightly surprised that I was writing this piece on the train back from Manchester yesterday, and I just messaged somebody, an older Spurs fan, and said, "Yeah, what sort of player was?" And you just sort of solid, don't really remember him. But on the group WhatsApp, this bloke's wife said, "Oh yeah, I remember him. I used to really fancy him." And I was like, "We're joking here." Yes. And you look at photographs, and
he's a good looking bloke.
He was a good looking bloke, and then there's a story in Hunter Davis, the Glory Game, you know, where he spent a year at Spurs, where I think it'd been a friendly against Rangers? I think it was against the Scottish side. And he'd been knocked unconscious. And the joke was he'd come round when he thought they were going to shave his hair to treat his ear. Because he was so proud of his sort of thick black locks. So yeah, he was very much sort of a ladies' man, late 60s, early 70s. Liked his gambling, you know, dogs and horses. So yeah, great player. Very good manager, maybe not quite such a good director. Football.
Yeah, so our thoughts, of course, with his friends and family, Joe Cunha, who's passed away at the age of 77. We'll be back in a second. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Exciting news in the break is that Dan has taken delivery of a tumble dryer. Is that?
No, I haven't yet.
All right, where is it?
They're struggling to find my house, so they called to try and confirm where the house is. And because I've only just moved here, I'm not great with the street names, so I don't know that I've probably hindered it more than anything.
But you know the street name that you live on, which seems quite a key part.
I know the road I live on, but not the roads around it. That was the problem. So I still might get me go on mute and disappear to receive a tumble dryer.
Is it a fancy tumble dryer? What have you gone for?
I didn't order it, to be honest. I can tell you that. I know you're interested in appliances and whatnot. Yeah. But a baker.
What was Rory Smith taking delivery of when he disappeared and never turned up again?
Rory Smith was taking delivery of like a sort of ornate...
Was it a chandelier or something?
No, I don't think it was a chandelier. I think I said it was a chandelier. It wasn't. It was some sort of mantelpiece type dresser affair. and he left and he didn't return. I don't know if he's been on since.
I don't think he has.
Pretty sure he's, you know, he's still kicking about.
he's still waiting on the Zoom for you to do it
again. Anyway, Luton 2, Bournemouth 1. They did it again, Baz. Oh, what a moment in injury time for Carlton Morris.
Yeah, and it clearly meant an awful lot to him because he broke down in tears after the game, took advantage of a defensive blunder to score from the Cawley Woodrow cross. And again, you know, Luton's fighting spirit is just a credit to them. They were missing 10 players, I think most of them more or less first choice for this game. Bournemouth are a decent side, and for Luton to come from behind and win this game and still be in touch is, I think, remarkable. And it was quite funny because the manager, Rob Edwards, after the game, you know, they said, oh, you'll have a drink tonight to celebrate that. And he went, no, I'm just going to be traumatised by the fact that we're playing Manchester City away next. I'm going to lie awake worrying how to deal with that.
Fighting spirit seems such a cliche for, you know, Dan, for a team with a really low budget and load of injuries. And it just, you feel like it's got to be more than that. Of course, there's some talented players there, but it's quite extraordinary what that sort of unquantifiable thing can do.
I do think a lot of it is to do with the manager. If you look at his body of work at Forest Green, and then he was, of course, let go very quickly at Watford. But I've spoken to a few people in the past about his time with the Wolves setup and the Wolves youth teams. And, you know, he's very, very highly thought of. He was seen as being quite innovative. And I think the way he is as a person as well, he comes across very, very well, seems like a genuine bloke. I do think when you marry that fighting spirit with a clever manager, I do think you also get into the patterns of a bit like Spurs at the moment. You know, in a Spurs game, there's going to be a goal between 45 minutes and 60 minutes. With Luton at the moment, whether it be one way or the other, you know there's going to be a late goal in those games. So although they've conceded in both ways, I do think at Kenilworth Road in particular, they do have this drive and this belief to keep going and think that it will come. It's almost become repetition.
Yeah. And it's interesting actually about Rob Edwards is at Forest Green, he played really nice football. The guy is a pragmatist, right? And he looks at what he's got and he does makes the best of whatever situation he's got, which is interesting, Wilson, the fact of where he could go as a manager, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think Luton are quite good to watch. I know what you mean. They're not sort of a tippy-tappy possession side, but I think they are quite good to watch. And Dan's off. The tumble dry has arrived. It's very exciting. Jordan Clark is a good player, isn't he? One of those players I'd seen in the Championship and wasn't quite sure about translate to the Premier League, but I think he's certainly the second half of the season, I think he's looked really good.
He's one of those players. There's another one, I forget who it is. Maybe it's Luke Berry. No, Luke Berry scored in League Two, League One, the Championship and the Premier League, but Jordan Clark has now scored in each of the top five divisions, which is such a great achievement. I was a big fan, Barry, of Iraola saying, you know, second half against the wind. And it was windy. You know, we got to James Ward-Prowse's free kick corner, rather. But just complaining about the wind feels so... It really takes me to Sunday League. Games where you go, oh, this is a two-goal win, this lads. Maybe he had a point.
Well, it was very windy this weekend in London, certainly. Ward-Prowse scored with a corner. Someone else nearly... Luca Dean nearly scored with a corner. We'll have to ask Dan when he comes back if it was windy at Villa Park. That Murillo shot... I think that might have been wind assisted as well. So Storm Kathleen was, you know, had a few assists and near assists over the weekend.
Oh, I guess if there's any ground where the wind is going to make a difference in the Premier League, it is Luton. Because the stands aren't high enough to stop it.
Yeah, true. I remember, I've only been to Kenilworth Road once, and it was windy and freezing cold. It was actually, they were playing Forest Green at the time, and it was one of the most miserable experiences of my life because I'd forgot my hat and gloves.
Do you think a low stands mean the wind obviously can get right in there? But if a stadium is designed in such a way that it could create a wind tunnel, you know, I sort of think...
You definitely get... I mean, I know there's some stadium alike that you could see from where the litter congregated. There was clearly like little eddies that kind of the wind gathered the litter. So it must
be. So James Ward-Prowse could get a ball in an eddy, in like a whirl, in a twister, and it would spin round and round. Like, is that good? And then it fly it out in the right direction. Would be tremendous, wouldn't it? They can do it, can't they? They're level on points with Forest now, Wilson. And, you know, Everton could have another points deduction. We don't know. But for them to even still be there, I'm not looking at anyone who might have written a piece four games in saying, what if they get no points this season? But that's such a brilliant achievement, even to get this far.
Yeah, I mean, that's sounds slightly in danger of patronising them. But yeah, they've with the budget they've got to... I think they've had a fun season. And the danger is when you go up as a smaller side, that it's just miserable. You're just getting battered every week. And that has not happened. They've been competitive in the majority of games, even if they haven't won them. There's been something to encourage them, something that's been fun. And so... Yeah, they could have ended up with 10 points or something. They could have taken Derby's record. But even if they go down, they've had a worthwhile season, not just financially, but they'll have had fun.
Dan, two questions. Was it windy at Villa Park? Question one.
Well, yeah, it was. I could tell you a little story. So,
here we go.
Jonathan's spoke to my dad on Zoom or whatever it was before. His movement's not brilliant at the moment as he's getting older. And I've said previously, he fails his fitness test every week for Villa Park, but right. I still take him every week. Okay. We've had season tickets for like 31 years. And my mum wasn't in when I picked him up to go to Villa Park, and he walked out without his stick, looking quite sheepish. So I thought straight away, mum can't be in because there's no way he would have walked out without that stick.
Yeah.
And so it turns out she wasn't in, and he said he didn't want to use any aids to walk this week. So I thought, okay. That's fine. And to be fair to him, he got to the Villa Park steps at the Holt End and had moved very, very well up until that point. As we were walking up the steps, the wind suddenly was coming down the stairs and he was clawing on to the banister. And I just stood there and watched him because he told me that he didn't want any aids. And then another man ran over to actually rescue him and stop him from falling.
So you were willing to let him fall down the steps just to prove a point?
It's what he wanted. That's all I can say. It's what he wanted. He said he didn't want any aid, be it a stick or me. So I decided to let him be. It was quite comical if you'd have seen it, but probably won't come across great for me on my first episode of this podcast.
No, absolutely fine. Just the idea of like him just holding on with his legs in the air. And the wind is trying to throw him down the stairs of the Holt End. And you're like, well, should have brought your stick, mate, shouldn't you? The other question is, Tumbledryer looks good on arrival?
I mean, I'm a bit out of breath because I had to carry it into the garage, but it's still packaged up. I'll text you later and let you know.
Carry it into the garage is quite impressive, isn't it? Anyway, let's go to Goodison Park. Everton 1, Burnley 0. Colin says, was having to watch Everton Burnley harder than running the length of Africa, which is a reference to this hardest geezer man who has just run from tip to top of said continent while on running. Well done, producer Joel. We're getting 3 hours 21 in the Brighton Marathon. Anyway, the Sean Dyche derby. And Sean Dyche, Barry, said, we designed an ugly win and it worked. And even Dyche, even for him, sounded gravelly after this one.
Yeah, it wasn't a great spectacle. And Burnley lost because of a stupid mistake playing the ball out from the back. And that's cost them time and again this season, and that's the reason they are where they are, I suppose. And Dominic Calvert-Lewin, he scored last week after a long, long drought. And I said last week, that's one positive Everton can take from the game, and he scored the winner in this one. So three very priceless points for Everton, which they may have to give back later this week. Along with a couple of other ones. But not a great spectacle, but a massive win for them. They won't flush, will they?
I found that goal very, very irritating because the fact that he scored a few days earlier against Newcastle, that's why I found it irritating, because commentators will always say, oh, he's desperate for a goal. He just needs something to hit him and go in. But because he scored the week before, I feel like that's ruined that analogy now.
Right. That should have been the goal that got him off the drought.
That needed to be the goal, didn't it, rather than the one against Newcastle?
That's it. And the thing about that pass, Wilson, is even if Calvert-Lewin isn't closing him down, the pass isn't on. Like the centre mid who's running to get the ball, there's like two Everton players sort of, it's an impossible, it's like De Bruyne's not making that pass.
And there was a different keeper, but it was exactly that pass that cost them the opening goal against Crystal Palace. I'm sorry, not the opening goal led to the red card against Crystal Palace when the score was at 0-0. I think if you've got to be very, very good to play a short pass centrally as a keeper, especially somebody under pressure. And you know they got themselves. You know, the red card in this game was they entirely self-inflicted. They, you know, they caused that themselves. And then yeah, and I thought there was a lot of, and then we'll get on to the worst example of it, but I thought there was a lot of ludicrous whining about referees this weekend. But Kompany saying that's not a red card.
Amazing. Like, brilliant, isn't it?
It's a red card. It's a red card for the foul because it's high, and it's a red card because it's denial of an obvious goal-scoring opportunity. So it's a double red card.
Yeah, he tried to say, you know, for it to be a goal-scoring opportunity, you've got to be in control of the ball, and he wasn't. Well, he wasn't in control of the ball because one of your players two-footed him in the knee. That is why he wasn't. He did also say, Vincent Kompany, in the last six games, we were the better team. So we could have had six wins. I mean, that's quite a big, it's like, you know, I don't feel like Burnley are just on the edge of six wins, you know, six straight wins in the Premier League.
They have showed definite signs of life and they have improved, but that was, yeah, totally self-inflicted defeat.
Yeah. And actually, I think Everton should have had another pen when Jay Rodriguez tripped James Garner. But anyway, on to refereeing decisions. Let's do the really fun Gary O'Neill one. Wolves 1, West Ham 2. You know, that assist for Storm Kathleen for James Ward-Prowse, direct from a corner. It's wonderful delivery. But obviously in the 93rd or whatever minute it was, Gary O'Neill incensed that Max Kilman's goal wasn't given. Tawanda Chiroa is in an offside position. IFAB Law 11 explains why it's disallowed, right? It's if you are impacting the vision or the movement of the keeper. Gary O'Neill seemed to say he wasn't impacting the vision, even though he was standing right in front of him. I mean, there's no way Fabianski is, or Areola for that matter, Barry, is saving that chance, right?
Well, he's not saving it because he can't see it.
Yeah.
So, like, that was totally correctly ruled out for offside. Now, Wolves have had several egregious decisions go against them this season that have cost them points against Man U, Newcastle, Sheffield United. There are three that I could thought of off the top of my head, but this was not one of them. And it was the way Gary O'Neill, the very condescending way he complained about it, like, it's the worst decision I've ever seen. No, it is, quite frankly, it isn't, because it's correct. And then it's the kind of decision that's made by someone who doesn't know anything about football. Like, Gary O'Neill played professional football for 18 years without knowing the offside rule. I find that remarkable.
Well, he said, yeah, if your knowledge of the game is really, really bad, yeah, that's how you come to have that decision. So does that mean, Wilson, your knowledge of the game is really, really bad?
Well, possibly. I'm quite happy to take him on a quiz about 1950s Hungarian football, which is the only football that really counts. Barry's right. It's just obviously offside. I mean, I think we get, you know, people are tying themselves in knots about, oh, you know, could the keeper see? Was the keeper going to get there? Doesn't matter. He's standing, you know, 2 feet in front of him. What if he... So you've now confused me to which keeper it was. Fabianski.
It was Fabianski, yeah. Yes. Yeah.
if he... You know, maybe he could have come and claimed the cross. I think that was not impossible. The header was from, what, five yards out? But he can't because of an offside player standing in his way. He can't sort of get his position right. He can't... He's got to be aware of the fact the ball might be headed down to this player. Yes, he's offside, but you still got to be conscious of that. And this idea that I was going in anyway... But you're now asking a referee to make a decision on whether the keeper had a chance of saving it. So, you know, if that had been a foot closer to him, would that be a goal? Yeah, probably yes. 2 feet close? Yeah. 3 feet? Oh, no, it's, you know, it's suddenly borderline. It's nonsense. Of course it's offside. It's manifestly offside. I would be happy for Wolves to be docked points for this. It's so pathetic. I'm so sick of managers and whining. And then pundits just parroting it because it's easy to complain about VAR and complain about referees. That decision was just correct on every single level. Nothing to do with VAR. Nothing to do with referees running a game from IFAB. Just because that's what offside is.
I really enjoyed the fact that
I take... I would cancel the licence fee because of that. Get Match of the Day off a telly. Get the BBC off a telly. Pull everything down. What's the... If they're going to say things like that, what's the point? Just end it all. Torch the entire civilization. End the species.
I did like the idea of Match of the Day that they said that, you know, what goalkeepers should do, right, is hide behind players Because then, obviously, at a corner, if you were a goalkeeper, you just immediately hid behind a player, then they would be in your line of sight wherever you were, right? And wherever the ball is, you could actually, by playing sort of football or hide and seek behind a large centre-back, you could get every goal disallowed. I mean, you have to drag them into an offside position first.
But also, what Gary O'Neill didn't point out was the penalty they got was, at best, 50-50. But, you know, a decision that goes his way, yeah, just gets ignored.
I liked it after the game when he said that he reeled off a list of people who thought that the goal should have stood and listed David Moyes in that list. And then the next interview was David Moyes and he said it was the right decision. That was my favourite thing about it.
Newcastle 1-1 at Fulham. Any strong thoughts on this one, Baz?
No. Newcastle, again, we mentioned the injuries. They were dismal in the first half. And Eddie Howe was very visibly very angry with his players, which you know, I'm sure he gets angry with them in the dressing room from time to time, but I've never seen him that publicly exercised before with his own team. And they got their shit together, basically, and went on to win the game with a good strike from Bruno Guimaraes. I don't know why I said good three times in a row there.
Good. That's all right.
It wasn't that good, but it's quite a good strike from Bruno Guimaraes.
Okay. Nag says, how do you feel, Max, knowing that Cambridge is blue and has a trophy as well? Winky face. Jim says, how long are you going to give Peterborough's thrilling auto windscreen shield victory? Is it still the auto windscreens? What is it now? The EFL trophy. Anyway, begrudging congratulations to Peterborough, who beat Wickham. They took the lead on 85 minutes. Wickham equalised in the last minute, and then Harrison Burrows got his second and a winner in the 91st minute. So well done, Posh. And I'll leave you with this from Edward. Says, hi, Max and the gang. Long time listener, first time caller here. I wanted to get in touch with you to let you know about a recent case of what I'd like to term and patent podception. Having just been in a local public house, witnessing my beloved Manchester United go full Glendening and lose all control against Chelsea, I decided to tune in to the most recent episode of the pod for my journey home to see whether your pre-match predictions were as accurate as always. I looked down at my phone and pressed play, and I was immediately greeted by Max's soothing tones and accessible banter. Thanks, that's what I like to be known for. Accessible banter, or anything worse.
Well, you're not challenging, are you?
No, that is true.
You're not pushing any boundaries.
How dare you? However, when I looked up, I was startled by bemused-looking grey-haired man with two suitcases walking up the stairs opposite me. I realised after a swift double-take that the bemused man before me was none other than the pod's very own Max Rushton, fresh from his Roman run-in with some open drains. Unfortunately, he was gone in a flash, and I didn't get the chance to speak to him about his trip or ask him about whether he'd had any tips on how to make sure I maintained a high performance in all that I do. I'd also like to know if any other listeners have also experienced a similar podception, or if it's only I who has the Midas touch. Thanks, Edward. Very occasionally, I don't know if you find this, Barry, somebody stops you and are listening to the pod, and I feel that is overkill to have you in your ears and in front of your face.
Somebody tapped me on the shoulder on the tube one day, and I turned around, it was this youngish kid, and he went, I'm listening to you right now. And, you know, I don't really know how to respond to that. Great, now you're listening to me in stereo.
I was going to a cricket match somewhere in North London and was walking along the edge of the North Circular from the tube station, and somebody pulled over to ask for directions because he'd seen my cricket bag on my back, and he was looking for a different cricket ground, as it turned out. And I said, sorry, I have no idea. I've never played here before. I don't know where your cricket ground is. And he then pulls in again 50 yards later, and I'm like, oh, God, I've already told him. I don't know where it is. And he goes, I just realised I'm listening to you right now.
Oh God, so, that's too much, isn't it? Well, you have our apologies if that happens to you. Anyway, look, that'll do for today. Thank you, Barry.
Thanks.
Delighted about your tumble dryer, Dan. Thank you.
No, thank you for having me.
Yeah, look after your dad. Thank you, Wilson.
Cheers. Thank you.
I just realised, Max. Remember, was it last week we had someone who was listening to me talking about someone having their head in the tumble dryer while they literally had their head in the tumble dryer.
Exactly.
And that, now, the tumble dryer, it's turning into quite the saga.
isn't it? I mean, I don't like long running sagas. So if this could stop immediately. yes, Dan?
Also, because I was receiving delivery of the tumble dryer, did I miss a game? What happened to the Chelsea Sheffield United game? I missed that. I missed that game.
No. We all missed it. Really good point. Well made. I skipped over it. Thank you, Dan. Could you do us a quick minute on it?
I didn't watch it, so I was just wondering if we were going to talk about it. I watched Match of the Day too.
Has anyone got a good minute on this, of Chelsea just doing what Chelsea do and it's all too late for Sheffield United? Would you say that, Baz?
I think it is too late for Sheffield United, but it was a very spirited performance by them in front of their home crowd, who haven't had a huge amount to cheer about at Bramall Lane in recent times. But yeah, it was a bit Chelsea being Chelsea, but I thought Gustavo Hamer had a brilliant game for United. Ollie McBurney was a constant menace. Noni Madueke was probably the standout player for Chelsea, and Thiago Silva was up and down. He scored a good goal, but wasn't one of his better performances.
So yeah, lucky we did that, because you know, otherwise people would be slightly annoyed. We have more chat about tumble dryers and magpies and Albert the Cat than we did about that game. But look, that is it now. We're done. Football Weekly is produced by Silas Gray. Our executive producer is Joshua Kelly.
This is The Guardian.